A video released in November by the New York Times showed about 24 Israeli undercover agents disguised as Palestinian civilians conducting an arrest raid on a West Bank hospital. It left the world wondering, who are the men behind the disguises? The surprising truth about these agents and their exhaustive secret campaign to halt the wave of terrorism in Israel is revealed in the new book, The Ghost Warriors: Inside Israel's Undercover War Against Suicide Terrorism. The book offers a rare, compelling, and disturbing inside look at Israel's small and highly secretive border guard undercover units. Samuel Katz is the author. He's an internationally recognized expert on Middle East security issues and a New York Times bestselling author. He introduces us to Hamas, a force of Arab-speaking Jewish, Druze, and Muslim citizens of Israel who masquerade as indigenous Palestinians in order to infiltrate terrorist-controlled areas and search for high-value targets wanted by Israeli intelligence. Again, the name of the book is The Ghost Warriors: Inside Israel's Undercover War Against Suicide Terrorism. We welcome Samuel Katz to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to this subject and wanting to look at it in more depth?
I've been writing about Israel's war against terrorism for the last 25 years and had noticed that throughout the struggles, throughout incidents for the last many years, there have been an intrepid group of individuals belonging to very select units that have taken it upon themselves an enormous burden in combating Palestinian terrorism on a day-to-day basis. And in typical Israeli fashion of something that's known as proactive deterrence, they have taken this struggle to the enemy. They have taken this struggle on an intelligence-driven effort to try and thwart as many attacks as possible by unraveling these terror networks. And the undercover units, professional units of Border Guard policemen who are made up of Druze and Bedouins and Jews and every piece of the Israeli mosaic have been for a great number of years masquerading as Palestinians, entering Palestinian areas and operating in a way to apprehend these individuals so that greater intelligence could be learned. During the Second Intifada from 2000 to 2005, 2006, these units carried out thousands of missions, arrested hundreds of operatives from Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and they killed a great many terrorists as well. And they were one of the turning points, one of the factors that allowed Israel to continue on life as usual while this terror campaign was fought.
Give us a sense of who makes up this most secretive force.
The unique thing about the units that I covered for the book, they're known in Hebrew as Hamas, which is a acronym for undercover unit. They consist of Druze, Bedouins, Arab Christians, Jews, newcomers from the former Soviet Union. The Border Guard traditionally has not been the elite corps that would exist in the Israel Defense Forces, but these guys who end up serving in these units represent a spirit, in many cases a stubborn, obstinate, I'm going to show them sort of spirit. And they also have a unique element within themselves of courage. It takes a great wherewithal to go out in a car with four other guys inside a Palestinian refugee camp that's controlled by Hamas to apprehend somebody. The backbone of these units are the native Arabic speakers, the people that can mimic the accents of the local towns, the people that understand the customs. And what the Israelis found with these units was that by understanding the cultural keys, by getting inside the minds of these people, how they live, how they think, it was easier in many cases to be able to humble them, to apprehend them, to predict where they would be, and to engage them in a way that didn't involve shock and awe and catastrophic loss of life and collateral damage. These were what the Israelis referred to as tweezer operations, very select, pulling people out of areas and getting to safety.
I'm curious as to where these tactical specialists ultimately get their orders from, who they get their orders from.
Well, everything, all of the units in Israel, all of the elite units, the special operations units that are involved in counterterrorism, are all working for the intelligence apparatus. All of everything is intelligence generated, and the Shin Bet, the Israeli Secret Service, will cultivate intelligence, and they will get the name and the location, the last known whereabouts of an individual. And then units will compete to see who can carry out an operation in the safest, sanest, and most plausible manner. Sometimes the operations are sensitive, depending on the family affiliation of one of the operatives, where he could be apprehended, if it involves going into a location that might be religiously sensitive. In some cases, the authorization for an operation might come from a general, it could come from the defense minister, could even come as high as the Israeli prime minister. But everything is intelligence generated, and it is based on facts, either from human sources, from electronic intelligence, or from the cultivation of signal intelligence, that this individual belongs to this operation, he might be here, and he has to be apprehended somehow, somewhere.
Talk a little bit about what they're fighting against, of the special insidious nature of suicide terrorism.
The landscape in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was really thrown aback in 2000 when Palestinian Authority Chairman Arafat unleashed the Intifada. He put his security services that were working with the Israelis at war with the Israelis, and he allowed, depending on the political expedience of what his ambitions were, he allowed groups like Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, who were supported by Iran and Syria, to carry out attacks. The reality, the phenomenon of suicide terrorism became a lifestyle in the West Bank and in Gaza. A cult of death was created. Individuals who carried out suicide bombings became rock stars. Their posters appeared on the walls of city centers and refugee camps. Their parents were paid an enormous amount of money. And this, almost this abolition of a day-to-day normalcy was created, where death was the ultimate objective. And their own death, as well as the death of many innocent Israeli citizens. The war was taken onto Israel cities, inside buses, inside cafes and restaurants. And it was really the first time that a first world nation, a nation like Israel that has the standard of living similar to any nation in Europe, found itself engulfed in a third world Islamic-generated asymmetrical war. And it was a war that, in the beginning, the Israelis found themselves dumbfounded with. In June of 2001, the first true catastrophic suicide bombing of the campaign happened, of a disco in Tel Aviv on the beach, in which 20 young kids were killed. Two months later, there was the bombing of a pizzeria in Jerusalem where 15 people were killed. And then September 11th happened, and all of a sudden, the mindset changed. And now the groups, they stood back for a bit, and not wanting to be connected to the global war on terror. But then shortly thereafter, they picked it up because they had to compete for news and headlines with what was going on in Afghanistan and elsewhere. And then in 2002, the deadly waves of bus bombings and bombings of hotels began. And for a nation of 6 million individuals, Israel began to suffer hundreds of dead a month, and it was intolerable. And there's the big picture always of diplomacy and the peace process, but the microscopic view of that, of a few operators going into a location to pick out somebody who the intelligence has picked out as responsible for several suicide bombings and who's planning several more, is the reality of what happens day to day on that landscape.
When you look at Hamas and what they are doing, Human rights groups, as you look at in the book, have labeled these units to be hit teams and squads that kill and capture terror suspects before due process. What can you say about that and the techniques that they use?
Well, first I'll talk about the techniques because obviously when a Palestinian operative is killed, the label of hit team comes, and the label is incorrect. The missions are dangerous. The operators who carry out these missions don't want to end up dead. And from their perspective, it would be much easier to drop a bomb on a house where somebody is suspected of living rather than going out and trying to arrest him. The due process is that the individuals are wanted for questioning. The individuals are wanted for crimes they have committed, and these are arrest teams to apprehend them. The standard operating procedure is the legal framework for the use of lethal force is if one of these individuals raises a weapon or is in proximity of a weapon that can threaten the forces that are going to arrest him, then they can use deadly force to neutralize him. And in many cases, the individuals who have been killed have tried to fight back and have ended up dead. So the label of hit team has struck. From a perspective from the Israelis who send out the Israeli leadership that sends out these units, there's a lot at risk. There's a risk that the Israelis will, the operators themselves, will be killed or captured, and that will create a whole set of scenarios that are nightmarish. It's much easier to launch a drone, which is the ultimate hit team. But here, the individuals who go out day in, day out, and there were times when these guys were out 60, 90 days at a stretch. They're out to find someone in particular, and they're out to apprehend him and not use lethal force. They're out to bring the individual back so that greater intelligence can be cultivated. There's the expression that one of the Shin Bet directors said that we'd rather snatch you than scratch you, because for the long-term picture, it's more important that these individuals be talked to. So the notion that these guys are rogue hit teams is incorrect. It's important to also understand, and this always gets lost in this discussion, that Israel's at war. The Palestinians are at war. And the use of these teams, these select strike units, is a way to minimize, ultimately, casualties, rather than going out and launching helicopter strikes or massive types of retaliation that would result in far more individuals being killed, including the deaths of innocents.
So the Intifada never really ended.
Well, yes and no. The Intifada petered out where the suicide bombings came to an end. And the suicide bombings came to an end due to an enormous number of reasons. One of the primary ones was that the war of attrition that was waged by units like the Hamas, especially the Hamas, against the Palestinian terror factions, tired them out. A lot of these individuals were either in custody or dead or in hiding. One of the objectives of a unit that masquerades as old women and old men and young students is that the bad guys never really know who's watching them. There isn't a moment of rest. These units are in essence, a psychological warfare tool to terrorize the terrorists. And after a while, they just became tired. Their abilities became lessened by this constant day-in, day-out approach. And there was a period after the Intifada when both sides kind of took a breath, especially in the West Bank, not in Gaza, where Hamas took over and began the use of rocket attacks against the Israelis, but in the West Bank and in around Jerusalem, where it became business as usual. People came in from the West Bank to Israel to work. It was a very common scene to see Israelis and Palestinians mingling on trains, on buses. And only recently, in the fall of 2015, was there a reemergence of sort of a I guess the correct way to say it, a light intifada, one where the terrorists were using knives and axes and screwdrivers instead of suicide bombs. And this could be a lull before the storm, or it could be that the leadership isn't in place yet. The operatives aren't in place to carry out an intifada like happened in 2000 to 2005.
But these units continue to be very busy.
Yes, and the unique thing about these units is that in the border guard units, which are professional units as opposed to army units, which are made up of 18, 19, and 20-year-old conscripts, is a lot of the individuals that were around when these units were created for the first intifada are still working almost 25 years after the fact. So they have experience. They're going in, day out. Their raids constantly. And in many cases, as reports have shown, there's cooperation and intelligence sharing between the Israelis and the Palestinian security services because both sides want to keep things quiet. I think both sides, it's in their better interest to keep a status quo going. And certainly with the emergence of ISIS, nobody wants a radicalized newcomer to enter an already messy pot of chaos. And I think most importantly, groups like Hamas and the Islamic Jihad are very wary of that kind of presence. So at the moment, I wouldn't say there is peace, and I wouldn't say there's intifada. There's a bit of a bloody remission going on.
You brought up ISIS, and it makes me wonder of how U.S. Special Forces work with Hamas and how these organizations coexist.
Well, U.S. Special Forces have visited these units. I cover that in the book. There is tactical sharing and technique sharing. Israel has a bit of a geographic plus going in its favor in that its battlefield is defined. Its areas of operation are clear-cut. The West Bank Hamas unit has to worry about towns like Jenin and Nablus and Tul Karm, and they can master mimicking the accents. They can master the geography. U.S. Special Forces, even the very top tier like Dev Group or Delta, can find themselves one day operating in Iraq, a month later focusing on Afghanistan, and 3 months later down the road looking at Somalia or even the Philippines or Nigeria or Kenya. Their battlefield is global, and the Israelis don't have that burden. So the Israelis are allowed to specialize, and I think in many ways that's why the Israelis have been able to achieve such great success, because they can really focus and master the enemy that they have. The enemy doesn't really change. And even with the evolution of ISIS, and I think everyone realizes that ultimately ISIS will find an address in the territories and target Israel, is that it's still the same families, it's the same individuals, it's the same terrain. So the Israelis have a leg up in having experience in dealing with that. And I think that other Western special forces, especially those that are committed to combating ISIS, are going to have to kind of learn that cultural key sensitivity to mimic the language, mimic the dress, mimic the nuances that will enable them to enter terrorist-held territory without their cover being blown, without the need and ultimate political hand grenade of large boots on the ground.
With that idea of a cover not being blown, you are writing about one of the most secretive forces of tactical specialists in the world, which does bring up the question of how you were able to get in and have them open up.
I've been working with these units for 25 years, and in many ways it's a story that needed to be told. At the end of the day, the people who are most familiar with their tactics are the people that they apprehend. A Hamas terrorist who was arrested by a Hamas team, where some of the individuals are dressed as old women selling fruit at the side of the road, know exactly how they were apprehended. The units aren't a secret, and it only makes their job more dangerous. The operations are known because individuals are apprehended. But the story, in many cases, were those that the operators wanted to tell, the command level wanted to tell. This campaign, especially in the Second Intifada, is a primer of how a Western nation can defeat terrorism without there being a massive war involved. And it is a look at how the use of small, very specialized units can ultimately infiltrate and undermine networks that are lavishly funded and that are connected by clans and secrecy and areas that intelligence services and special operations units would have a very difficult time in penetrating.
What is the shelf life of an individual agent?
Well, some of them have been working for 25 years. A lot of these become very, this is their profession. This is what they do. It's cliche to say that they're defending their homes, but they are. The separation between a West Bank refugee camp and Tel Aviv or Haifa is an hour's drive, 40-minute drive. So the proximity makes it like going to work. These guys are in it for the long haul in many cases. Most of the units are about 60% old-timers and 40% newcomers and conscripts. The shelf life is yet to really have been studied, in as much as the lifestyle is incredibly unhealthy. Because of the fact that they're experienced and that they're very careful, not many have been killed in action. Several have been wounded, but the toll on their bodies and their minds in terms of caffeine, nicotine, loss of sleep, anxiety, and stress is enormous. A lot of these individuals, it's not very macho in Israel to talk about PTSD, but they suffer for it. One of the operators told me that, he found himself sometimes, at night, choking himself or mumbling and doing things that, terrified his wife. The psychological scars are there, but this is what they do. They've become accustomed to it. And in many cases, especially in these smaller units, these guys are the only ones that can do it. In the book, I liken them to the RAF pilots during the Battle of Britain. They enjoy the fact that there's an enormous burden on their shoulders. They take great pride that they're able to do this. When they're able to snatch someone that other commando units have been unable to get, and they can bring him in alive to the authorities, it's a source of pride. It's a source of great achievement. And I'm sure that one day there should be a psychological study on these individuals. But they're not the the typical weightlifting alpha males that you find in other special forces. In many cases, these individuals are very humble, very quiet. But they feel that they possess a special knowledge, they possess a special skill, and they absolutely possess a special breed of courage that others simply don't have. And I think when you combine that, they realize that this is their calling, and they accept that.
The name of the book, The Ghost Warriors, Inside Israel's Undercover War Against Suicide Terrorism. The book is published by Berkeley. Samuel Katz, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Again, Samuel Katz is the author of the new book, The Ghost Warriors, Inside Israel's Undercover War Against Suicide Terrorism. It is published by Berkeley. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.